live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to see how we can drop down that weight and do it in an easy way, why the deep collar root vegetables are so important, tomatoes, dandelions, and hawthorn, why they trump Obamacare. Yeah, we're going to have an interesting commentary and discussion on that. And then the omega-3s inhibit breast cancer tumor growth, a new study. That's exciting. So we always bring the latest in health and nutrition and healing, always from peer-reviewed literature. Then a commentary today on our series of important issues. This is from Nguyen Banzai, and it's all about fascism and powerful men and women and the laws they make in secret and why we're allowing it, or at least those who don't speak up allow it. Also today, from our public health segment, a new series in our show, The Cancer Cash Cycle, It's All a Game, Colin Todhunter from Countercurrents. We're also going to talk about how the EPA scientists don't like water fluoridation. What do they know that we don't? So I'll give you the latest report from Gaia Health on EPA scientists opposing water fluoridation, and yet think of how many times those of us who've looked at the real science, public health science, and show that water fluoridation first doesn't work in most cases, and secondly, it's toxic at one part per million, the amount you get in a glass of water, and cancers, over 30 cancers a year that people die from, are due to water fluoridation, according to the former founder of the National Cancer Institute, and Dr. Dean Burke and Dr. John Yamianis. So I'll share that with you. One of the more interesting guests, because this aligns with the years of research I did in Psy research at the Institute. My guest today is Dr. Julia Asante. She's received her doctorate from Columbia University, and she's also been a professor at Columbia and University of Munster in Germany, published in peer-reviewed literature. What's the topic? Scientific and intuitive explorations into the afterlife. And it's important in our breaking the fear of the death cycle in our society. Well, we've been conditioned by both liberals and conservatives that we should deny as much as we can about death. And yet, she is absolutely of the belief that people can communicate with the deceased. How about that for an interesting discussion? We'll talk about that. And then I'll reveal some of my own research into the field. Let's begin. There is a nutrient that historically has been used for the heart because it gives energy to the mitochondria in the heart. It's called carnitine. Now, carnitine is spelled C-A-R-N-I-T-I-N-E. Generally at a 500 milligram dose, two or three times. If you're an athlete, if you've had trouble with your heart, if you've had, let's say, tachycardia or arrhythmias, you probably want 1,000 milligrams. But here's the study that showed that you can lose weight. And it says, quote, a daily dose of 500 milligrams of L-carnitine coupled with motivated training can help weight loss in overweight individuals. And that was a small, double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled study of overweight Japanese men and, quote, found significant body weight loss and a decrease in their serum triglycerides against a group taking placebo. The benefits, quote, of taking L-carnitine were amplified by motivated training. So that's good. L-carnitine now, for those of you who want to lose weight. The deep collars boost fruit's preventative superpower. Now, this is from the American Heart Association's journal Circulation. And this was important research done at Ohio State University. Here's what it says. Do not underestimate the blueberry. What it lacks in size, it more than makes up for in health benefits. Long heralded by nutritionists, the blueberry has been reported to benefit brain health and to help inhibit type 2 diabetes. And a study published in the American Heart Association's journal Circulation suggested eating 3 servings of berries a day can reduce the risk of heart disease in some women. What makes this superfood so super? Bioactive elements called flavonoids. No, that's what they're saying. We know, however, that the flavonoids are anthocyanins, and this is what gives them their unique color. Now, their flavonoids, like quercetin and apigenin, that you find in onions and apples and broccoli, are also doing the same thing as in berries. And then you have what are called naringens. They're found in citrus fruits. And catechins are found in like green tea and black tea and red tea and oolong tea. And then genistein, that's found in legumes and soy. So there's a whole family of these nutrients, not just in blueberries. Now, they studied just the blueberries, but they made a very impressive statement. It's not often that you hear a major orthodox scientific group like the American Heart Association in their journal Circulation saying blueberries 3 times a day and you can reduce, if you're a woman, your risk of heart attacks. That's a big deal. That's the kind of things we have said over the decades. But as of today, they've joined us. And it's fine that it's taken them all this time to figure out why we have had our audiences and reversing disease, and now they're catching up. So I commend them. So for all of you who want to improve your chance of not having a heart attack, just eat the healthy colored foods, fruits or vegetables. It'll make a big difference in your health. Then we come to tomatoes and dandelions and hawthorn. And why, according to Lance Johnson in Natural News, why they trump Obamacare. Here's what he says. It's short, little commentary, but I thought it was a value to us. And by the way, I'm doing an entire evening on what's wrong with Obamacare. And this is as much to the defenders of Obamacare, or some part of it. They just don't understand. They haven't looked at all of it, what it really means. More people actually die because of mandatory Obamacare, and they're just clueless on this. We could be causing thousands, tens of thousands of more deaths per year if people are forced to use the model medical model, which itself is flawed. See, the liberals, the corporate liberals, and the corporate conservatives never challenge the actual medical procedures or the pharmaceuticals or the diagnosis. They simply accept that whatever treatments are given are necessary. Well, I'm challenging the actual medical model. If you start off with a flawed medical model that itself can kill people and does, more people die from our failed medical model, iatrogenesis, than die of heart attacks or strokes or cancer or diabetes as individual diseases. So it's the number one killer in the United States. So if you're starting off with something that doesn't work, why in the world would you mandate that everyone has to take that? All you're going to do is kill more people. So anyhow, I'm going to spend an entire program on this. Here's what Lance Johnson says. The Affordable Care Act seems compassionate, but its one-size-fits-all philosophy suppresses real health care, the kind found growing freely and more affordable in nature. Fully implemented in 2014, this law mandates every American purchase health insurance. This is the first time in U.S. history that Americans are required to buy a product. This one-size-fits-all mandate of heralded holding people's health philosophy is misguided, ignorant, bankrupt, and tyrannical. It flies in the face of real health, The most successful, healthy people know from experience that the most effective, healthy philosophy is simply a lifestyle of nutrition utilizing positive thinking also. Eating tomatoes is cheaper than disease management drugs. The mysterious elements of foods, the nutrients, minerals, enzymes, antioxidants inside are absolutely necessary for healthy survival. These blessings of nature, when digested in their real form, are important for energizing the body and mind. The best part about nutrition, it was never intended to cause bankruptcy. You can find nutritious blessings growing freely in the pasture, in the park, in the woods, in the vacant lots, in the garden. Tomatoes, for example, are more than just food. They are a medicine. The lycopene inside a tomato is a powerful antioxidant that aggressively scavenges free radicals from its surroundings. Many chronic diseases result from tissue injury caused by free radicals. Free radicals can trigger chain reactions that damage lipid membranes, enzymes, chromosomes, and other cellular components. By utilizing antioxidants, one can prevent free radical damage to cells, keeping disease at bay. This is the philosophy of real health insurance, taking care of the root causes. The dandelion, the most affordable disease preventing medicine for diabetes. The government is trying to make a pharmaceutical drug more affordable, but drugs don't create health. They suppress symptoms and cause new problems. For example, diabetes can be treated with a particular drug which stimulates the pancreas to create more insulin. Ultimately, this causes low blood glucose, upset stomach, skin rashes, and weight gain. And another may help, but also causes congestive heart failure. Ultimately, there are natural options like the abundant, affordable dandelion. Dandelions aren't just weeds. Packed with vitamin A, C, iron, calcium, dandelions are strong detoxification foods. Dandelion juice can help diabetic patients by stimulating the production of insulin from the pancreas, keeping the blood sugar levels low. As a diuretic, dandelion makes the diabetic patient urinate frequently, removing the extra sugar from the blood. And since they are a bitter, they are also lower in sugar and help lower the blood sugar in the body. The hawthorn berry trumps heart prescription drugs. Low sex drive, dizziness, the fatigue, all clinical side effects of current heart prescription drugs. This is counterproductive and enslaving. Why not try hawthorn berries instead? The German Commission E, a scientific body which determines the effectiveness of herbal medicines, recommend hawthorn for, quote, cardiac insufficiency, cardiac pressure and tightness, the aging heart, mild bradyarrhythmia, increasing coronary and myocardial circulation. And all that from hawthorn. Enough said. This berry, rich in antioxidant flavonoids, benefits the heart through powerful anti-inflammatory, relaxing effects on the blood vessels. One cannot overdose on hawthorn either. It's a berry of safety and longevity. Why do heart medications even exist, when we know all about this powerful berry? Why do Americans cling to health insurances and government mandates? There are more affordable, simpler answers to health all around. Positivity, creativity, and nature will pave the way for real health care. And that's the end of the quote. Now, a couple of thoughts on that. There are times, of course, when we need medicines, when you need the best that American medicine can be. And I've always emphasized that what works in American medicine is its capacity to save lives in trauma, injury, accident, emergency medicine. If you need, if you need a microsurgery to sew back on a finger, if you need to have your jaw that was broken in a car wreck reassembled, if you need the surgery to excise a tumor, if you need... And it goes on. But those are all based upon emergency care. It is in the chronic care that medicine has failed and is so dangerous. It is giving expensive statin drugs that destroy ubiquinone in the body, coenzyme Q10, which is necessary to protect our heart, and all the other minerals and nutrients that are destroyed when you take medications. It is the entire rash of anti-inflammatory medicines that have killed tens of thousands of Americans and do so every year. And yet, medicine doesn't think. It responds to mandates from its think tanks that the pharmaceutical industry funds. Most Americans are now becoming aware of this, and that's important. So, real health care starts with preventing, and prevention starts with education. And education starts with objective, independent thinkers in all fields. And we don't have that. Every ad you see on television is manipulating you to believe that if you take that pill or eat that food, you're going to feel better about yourself and your condition will be improved. Think of how they play upon men's fear of not being alpha or masculine enough. Think of the way they sell us beers. And think of how they manipulate us to buy a certain car. Now, I have a car. I have a very high miles per gallon car. It's a very inexpensive, very simple car. But then I have a car that has some style. Oh, did I forget? I wouldn't buy a car past 1960. The most beautiful, creative, original, dynamic cars, from my opinion, are those from the 1920s through the 1950s. Get behind the wheel of a 1957 Chevy convertible, or a Ford Fairlane, or a T-Bird. Now, those are cars. These things today look like leg shells. They all look the same to me, all of them. You know, and they emphasize what? It's all in the illusion. Driving at 100 miles an hour around curves, and suddenly a sexy person is behind the wheel. Well, is that going to make me sexy if I drive 100 miles an hour? No, I'll end up with a wreck or a ticket, and no one's going to think you're sexy. It's all the illusion. But that's how they get everyone to buy what they want. Create an illusion. We don't have any good information on health. We don't show people how to prevent illness. We don't show them what choices not to make, because that would be interfering in that free market manipulation. But we have no problem in convincing people to eat everything they shouldn't, drink everything that should never go in the body, and then when they get sick, which is inevitable from this, take their worthless and dangerous drugs. What a system. This is the latest study published in the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry, done at the University of Guelph. Omega-3s inhibit breast cancer tumor growth. Quote, a lifetime diet rich in the omega-3 fatty acids can inhibit growth of breast cancer tumors by 30%. It is a significant finding, said the Professor Mao at the Department of Human Health and Nutrition Sciences. We show that lifelong exposure to the omega-3 fatty acids has a beneficial role in disease prevention, in this case, breast cancer prevention. What's important is that we have proven that omega-3s are the driving force and not something else. End quote. Well, let's see. That would be a handful of walnuts or some flaxseed oil in the morning. Almonds. Eating avocados. Lots of ways to get your flaxseed. Or for those who use it, milk. Fish. Tomorrow, for those in this audience who care about your prostate, what does milk consumption have to do with your prostate? I'm Gary Knoll. Now let's go to our public health segment. This is from Colin Todd Hunter from Counter Currents, and we have posted it on our website. By the way, my commentary yesterday, which I've received, I'm out on the road, but I've heard from my office, we were flooded with people commenting on it. Thank you for your comments, and it is posted. My suggestion, please share this with as many people as you can on as many sites as you can. Because that's how we're able to spread the information. Because no mainstream media is going to touch an article, or let alone a commentary, that accuses them of being a part of the problem. All right, so that's from yesterday. And you'll find that up on Progressive Radio Network, GaryNall.com, or my Facebook. And by the way, I also was told that we just hit a new record of people listening over the telephone all over America, because they can not only just monitor how many people are listening, but from where. And so we're very pleased that people no longer are confined to a radio or a computer, but can go anywhere. And as long as you got your telephone, just put it on speaker, and you can listen to this show. The number to call to listen to this show, number one in all of North America, South America, and Canada, and second in the world. And here is the number for you to call in and listen. 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. Now, this is from on cancer. Cancer is big business. Despite massive public screening campaigns and talk of cures, cancer rates continue to go up. And certain companies not only profit from making the chemicals that cause cancer, but also from selling the drugs that treat it. In the documentary, Cut, Poison, Burn, by the way, a very good documentary, I recommend people watch it, provides revealing insight into the medical monopoly of cancer treatment. As a four-year-old boy who was diagnosed with brain cancer was compelled to undergo a system of chemo, surgery, and radiation against his parents' wishes, he was not allowed access to a proven method of alternative treatment. The medical system's response was callous. The authorities threatened to take the boy into custody and charge the parents with child abuse if the medical option was not opted for. The boy's death certificate states his cause of death is, quote, respiratory failure due to chronic toxicity of chemotherapy. It's easy to conclude from watching the film that what we have here is some kind of corrupt racket. Indeed, in 2009, the documentary The Idiot Cycle claims that some of the world's top cancer-causing culprits, including, it is claimed, Bayer, BASF, DuPont, Dow, Monsanto, Syngenta, Novartis, Pfizer, among others, are profiting from the production of cancer-causing products, and then some of the same companies are investing in profitable cancer treatments. On top of this, some of these companies are now developing genetically modified crops, which have never been adequately tested for long-term health impacts like cancer. The onset of the disease is frequently 10 to 15 years down the road for victims. Used to be 40 years. Prior to undertaking his recent study into health impacts of GMOs and incurring the wrath of the GMO sector for his findings, Dr. Eric Seralini, the professor of molecular biology at the University of Caen in France, said it was absurd that only 3 months of testing allowed GMO corn to be approved in over a dozen nations. Upon reviewing Monsanto's raw data, he and his team found, among other problems, liver damage and physiological changes into pre-diabetic conditions among rats which had eaten Monsanto's GM corn. And that's just from 3 months of eating such food. His new study was over a two-year period. And what did he find? Cancer. But it happened after 90 days. Ah, that's the game. All the GMO companies knew, as long as we could keep the test results to 90 days, the cancer would manifest. But the moment you went over 90 days and you went to 2 years, all these cancers manifest. So that is malice aforethought. They knew the truth and they hid it. They engaged in crimes against humanity. The incidence of cancer is escalating and expected to double. And it's a global disease. For example, the incidence of cancer for some major organs in India is the highest in the world. While tobacco is a major cause, other factors cannot be discounted. Recent reports in the Indian media have drawn attention to rising rates of breast cancer in urban areas. And in 2009, there was a reported increase in cancer rates in Tamil and next to the textile belt, possibly due to chemically contaminated water. According to Dr. Samuel Epstein, Emeritus Professor of Environmental Medicine at the University of Illinois, a range of industries in the United States has contaminated the air, land, and sea with a wide range of petrochemical and other carcinogens. This has not only affected the public at large, but has also placed workers in certain sectors and their offspring at risk of cancer. Epstein notes that the incidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma has increased over 100% over the last few decades, and brain cancers by 90%. Breast cancer has gone up 65%, testicular cancer 35%, and now it's increasing in men by 300%. Epstein asserts that there has been a massive escalation in the incidence of cancer that cannot be explained away on the basis of smoking, longevity, genetics, or fatty diets. And he's right. In the U.S., animal and dairy products are contaminated with a wide range of hormones and pesticides and other industrial chemical carcinogens, and some of which are very important risk factors for reproductive cancers, like cancer of the testicles in men, and breast cancer in women, and leukemia in children. The use of the IGF-1 growth hormone in milk has been associated with breast, prostate, and colon cancer. Epstein provides various examples of everyday taken-for-granted household items, cosmetics, and toiletries, from deodorants to shampoo, from talcum powder, which also contains chemicals that are carcinogens. The conclusion is that synthetic chemicals and their effects on people's health affect everybody simply because they can be found in so many consumer products today. Unfortunately, many governments roll over all too easily when it comes to sanctioning new synthetic chemicals without adequate testing, which is not too surprising, especially when pharmaceuticals are concerned. Substantially more money is spent by companies on marketing and lobbying than on actual research into their drugs. The usual tactic of officialdom is to individualize health issues by advising people to change their behavior. And while in certain cases individual behavior may indeed minimize risk, there is not much the individual can do in terms of many of the major cancers that have increased in recent decades. By adapting a blame-the-victim strategy, attention is diverted away from the practices of large profiteering corporations that cause cancer and ill health. I filmed Dr. Shiv Chopra in Canada to talk about his many battles against the Canadian government, which knowingly allowed dangerous drugs and agricultural practices and carcinogenic pesticides to enter the food supply. Chopra asserts that there is a concerted effort by companies to sicken and then treat humanity while raking in massive profits. Whistleblowers like Chopra are playing a valuable role by exposing corrupt practices, and films like Cut, Burn, Poison and The Idiot Cycle are helping to shed light on the failure of the war on cancer, which is corrupt and has failed. At the same time, a number of pressure groups are actually engaged in trying to phase out the use of carcinogenic chemicals and products, as was the case when the tobacco companies were taken on. Tough, yes, but we can make a difference. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay on hold. Everyone, I'm Gary Nall, on the road, doing a new documentary. We'll have it finished in about 3 weeks, and then back to the city. Also, for all of you wanting the latest articles that are completely different than those you're going to find in The Nation magazine or Huffington Post or on the other blogs that are ideologically aligned, go to our site and look at the hundreds that we post constantly, day and night, on progressive themes, always giving you the cutting edge. They're free, and they're there for you. My guest is on our line now. I gave you her background earlier, Dr. Julia Sante, who received her doctorate from Columbia University, where she specializes in ancient languages and the intersection of religion, magic, gender, and sexuality in the ancient world. And she's also been a professor at Columbia and other schools. And she is the author of The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Gary. Thank you for inviting me.
In the 1970s and 80s and 90s at the Institute of Applied Biology, I was a research fellow doing most of my known research on anti-aging and with animals and with humans. But on the side, my real passion was doing psi research.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we were looking at is, could we show any proof where people could communicate with those who have passed? And we had some remarkable findings. And I was working at that time with a rabbi from Brooklyn, Abraham Wiseman, and also Dr. The PhD head of nursing at New York University, Dolores Krieger, who then went on to form Therapeutic Touch and many others. And what we found was, and this was what really motivated me, was that we all are engaged throughout our life in sharing or exchanging energy. And though the physical matter of life ends, the vibration that is the core of our life cannot, because we can't destroy energy. We can only alter its form and use. And therefore, my thought was, well, then what is life except the life force? And what is in the life force except all that we need in order to establish that vibration? Now, that's just a real gross oversimplification. I spent a lot of time on this, a lot of research. But I know that when we talk with people, upwards of 72% of people in the United States claim that they have had contact with the dead. 92%, according to you, of widows claim that they contacted with their deceased husbands. And 75% of parents who have lost a child say they've encountered their child afterwards. And 3 out of 4 state that they are afraid to speak about their confrontations with people who have passed away because people won't understand. They'll think they're crazy. So would you please take us through the idea? First, lay out the hypothesis. Is it possible to communicate with those who've passed? And if so, give us examples that are credible, and then explain what you believe is the basis for this. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Okay. First of all, that 72% you cited is from the best survey that's been done so far. It was a 5-year survey. However, it didn't include children. It didn't include the dying who routinely see the dead, the deceased around them. It didn't include any kind of mediumship, professional work, all the people today who are using induced after-death communication for therapy. It didn't include prayer. It didn't include mental conversations. It didn't include dreams. So if you add all of that up, you're looking at what I would suspect is 100% of communication. It goes on and on. It's just telepathy. And everybody has telepathy, and that's been proved over and over again clinically. So just to get that out of the way, it really is much higher than 72%. That 72% is based on only spontaneous encounters with adults. So and if you're looking at proof for after-death communication, I think you have a conundrum, because anything they tell you, if it can be proved in our plane, on the earth plane, it can also be considered something that you might have picked up telepathically or through precognition. In other words, from normal psi abilities and not from the dead. So that's a problem. So you have to receive information that only the dead know after they've died. It can't even be something that they knew when they were alive, because that would be in our records, and we would know about it, and we could somehow access that through remote viewing or whatever. So proving that you're talking to the dead and no one else is actually a very tiny little window that you have that would be considered proof rather than evidence. For evidence, we have tons. In my book, I look at what constitutes evidence in terms of after-death communication, and uncovered, in the hundreds of thousands of accounts that are now published, uncovered a few where the dead found out something after they died that no living person knew and transmitted that information. Then you've got something. So it's a real problem. On the other hand, if you look at the effects of after-death communication, for instance, of a woman who sees her, has an encounter with her daughter, and she doesn't even know that her daughter just died, that's quite a powerful thing, but you could say that's precognition. You certainly can't say that it's fantasy. And she finds out, the mother finds out immediately afterwards that her daughter died in a fatal car accident. That's evidence. It's not proof. Do you following me?
Sure. Give us more examples of this, please.
Yeah.
And go into a little depth on some of the examples.
Yeah. Okay. And then on the other hand, you have, through this induced after-death communication therapy, of which there are many different types that are used for bereavement, you have instances in which a single session of after-death communication set up by a therapist will wipe out death-related post-traumatic stress syndrome or disorder that's been in place for 20, 30 years of intrusive memories, nightmares, sweats, depression, and suicidal longing gone with one communication with the dead. In all scientific proof, much of it is based on effect rather than, for instance, we don't know if there's a Big Bang, but we have the effects of a Big Bang. Therefore, a Big Bang is likely. So if you have the effects of this kind of cure, it's likely that that cure is coming from after-death communication. That's as close as we're getting to proof with after-death communication. We have instances where this therapy has healed people who had tremendous trauma in their childhood, and their parents come back and try to show their remorse. In one case, it was a guy whose father was a heavy drinker and brought his drunken buddies home, raped him and his two sisters. His two sisters committed suicide when they became adults, and the brother wanted to commit suicide and went to one of these therapists. And then the after-death communication started. It first started with one sister who committed suicide more recently, and she begged him not to commit suicide, and they started connecting with the other sister and then finally with the father. And this man, now a man, who had been raped in childhood, who had been put in closets while they raped his sisters, these guys, was so afraid that he even lost control over his bowels, even having a dream with his father. And finally he got up the nerve, he realized that his father really felt remorse, and it's such a deep remorse. So he got up the nerve to face his father in after-death communication, and the whole thing unlocked. His suicide longings left, his anger left, the forgiveness came flooding in, and he found his authentic self through forgiveness, and he had a life. And when you can imagine that the kind of effect that these sessions might have on someone, there's something very real happening. The other thing that makes it real for me, and this is something that when I teach people how to do after-death communication, because it's much more effective if a person has direct communication with deceased loved ones rather than going through a medium, is to recognize the physical effects of a presence, such as a tingling. It's the most common and one that people often have without realizing what it means, this tingling sensation that goes through your body. And once you have that reference point and know what that means, you can launch into two-way discussion, and it will never leave you. You'll always always have it, and you'll be able to recognize it in more subtler ways than ever before. It's something that is easy to learn. So these physical effects are quite common. There are others that occur when the deceased are trying to get your attention. Generally, they do all kinds of tricks, especially with electronics, with your lights blowing out. A lot of people discover pictures on of the deceased on the floor out of nowhere, or a picture of them on the wall might start to glow or fall off. Telephone calls. There are instances of telephone calls of a person speaking a full hour with someone, and she didn't even know the person was dead. Or the telephone call comes through when the telephone is out of service or not even connected. And so there's a lot of phenomena that occur around the dead trying to reach us or trying to get our attention. And so it's a very active on their side. The point that I try to make with people is you don't have to wait for them to get in touch with you. You can do it with your own intention if you proceed from your strongest emotion. You proceed from your most honest feelings. And that is like a beeper that will call the dead, the departed person you want to reach in.
So you have, unlike some of the expressions in the Eastern religions, the fear of death is ingrained in Western society, especially today when radical secularism and extremist literal religious beliefs have dominated much of the Western mindset. So I'd like for you to also just share your views on the adverse effects of this fear. And then, why is this fear so debilitating and detrimental? And finally, who benefits from keeping the fear of death and the uncertainty of the afterlife embedded in our culture?
Right.
For example, how does the media or government or corporate propaganda benefit from keeping people in this fear of death and to doubt themselves concerning afterlife experiences?
Oh, yeah. Well, the fear also certainly comes from religion. If you even look at the book of creation, in the story of creation, the Adam and Eve, death is a punishment. It's not even part of a natural cycle. And when you die, you die. There is no existence afterwards. That was much debated in Judaism before the first century. The Orthodox view was there was no afterlife. And a person who did die certainly was not expected to reunite with the divine. Yahweh or Jehovah was a god of the living, and the dead were communicating with the dead was outlawed, mainly because the dead were regarded as divine, and so there could not be any other divinities in this cult. So that's one thing. Necromancy, as it was called, is still called, was punishable by pain of stoning to death. It's pretty severe. And from that, we have very bad ideas about, I mean, even the word necromancy brings up all kinds of macabre visions. But from that, we have a certain kind of deeply embedded prohibition. Whereas before these Judaic reforms, people communicated with the dead all the time. And they buried, even the ancient Jews, buried the dead under their floors. They had shrines in their homes. They had special rituals that they did. But there was also an ongoing communication, which we have in cuneiform letter writing, for instance, or incantations, in which you could put a salve on your face so that the dead could see you better. It was, you know, quite a lot of traffic between the two worlds until these Judaic reforms. So that's one side, of course, and producing a lot of fear about death, because it was not understood what happens to you. In the apocalyptic vision, which occurred later, what happens to you is that you go to sleep, and if you were not one of the righteous, you become extinct. If you're one of the righteous, you resurrect again in the body. So again, there's no afterlife in this picture, not really. There were certain versions, but the mainstream idea of the apocalypse was there was no real afterlife. The afterlife that we have now developed a few centuries later.
Well, let me just interrupt for a moment, because that I'm sure many people in this audience want to know what happens when there is an afterlife experience. But when we look at the different metaphysical and cosmological systems and beliefs regarding the afterlife, they can more or less be divided, I would imagine, into two separate groups with sub-variations. But one would be some kind of permanent afterlife, whether it be heaven or hell or a kind of endless evolutionary progression that some esoteric traditions hold. Or there is the grouping that involves reincarnation and transmigration in some shape or form. Now, based upon your many afterlife encounters, where do you come down on this divide?
Differently. I would say that there's two kinds. There's an exclusive type in which a person can get into heaven under certain conditions, or have an afterlife under certain conditions. And then there's the inclusive, which are more traditional, which included Mesopotamia and most native religions. These are religions that don't have institutionalized cults that control afterlife. That's a really important distinction. In the inclusive version, it doesn't matter what you've done, you still have eternity, you still have immortality, and you sort of slip from one world to the other. The reincarnation system is also based on reward and punishment, unfortunately, and the way we have it construed now does not actually reflect the facts. When you die from an incarnation, you have an afterlife. You don't abandon that afterlife to come back into a new body. It's all simultaneous. You have an afterlife and you have many incarnations, and each incarnation has its own afterlife. No part of that personality dies, not even the ego. So it's to talk about reincarnation as something that exists in a time-bound cause and effect universe is problematic, because really afterlife is a non-local reality. In time, space, all of that doesn't really exist. So I would divide these two systems up between inclusive and exclusive. Exclusive started to show up in the Middle Kingdom a little bit, where the weighing of the feather against the soul and to judge the morality of the soul. So that's about 1500 BC. It's quite new in the world, really. But in terms of your other question, Gary, the one about who benefits from the fear of death, there's almost nothing you can name that doesn't benefit from it. Certainly the most outstanding would be the war industry and certain other things where government uses death threats to develop new programs and break Bill of Rights and things of that sort, you know, things that lean more a little on police state. That's a pretty radical statement, so I'm backing away from that for a minute. But certainly things like the insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies and in medicine itself and medical industry, all the advertisements you see on television about what disease you're going to get, just constant emphasis on physical health and disease. The body is a time bomb. You can't trust it. You have to do everything in the world to fight off the aging process, to fight off the decline, to fight off death, which medicine has turned into a pathology.
Okay. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to get to two very important issues. And I know many people who have contacted loved ones who have died have noted that at some point it seemed like the communication simply stops, as if they are no longer reachable. Is there a point when the departed is no longer accessible, or does it mean that means to connect with him or her has changed?
I think it's a little bit more like when someone moves away. You have a lot of contact in the beginning, it tapers off, and then you reunite at some point as though there was never any lost contact. That's more or less the profile. For myself, I have quite ongoing contact with my parents and several other people, really, friends. It's quite ongoing, but it takes a little bit of deep listening and awareness to realize that and to work with it. So it is true, certainly, that the most extraordinary contact comes directly after a person's demise. There's no question about that. And it's quite open, but that can go on for a few years in itself. But it's also true that they never really leave us. And there's no actual point, because they don't live in a time zone the way we do. They can move in on our futures and on our past. So it's not a matter of time. There are instances in which they don't want to communicate. There's no need to communicate. There are geomagnetic reasons. There's solar flare reasons where communication becomes more difficult. There's psychological difficulties sometimes. Sometimes a dead person is not a good communicator. But for the most part, the notion that they're too far away or too busy or whatever, that can be also true, but it doesn't mean that they're entirely unavailable. They can multitask. They can be transcendent and still be present at your wedding.
Here is a very important question. I've saved this for last. When they communicate with you or other people, I'm sure that you've asked, where are you at? What do you see? What do you smell? What do you hear? What can you observe? What? Tell me about your environment. Could you explain that, please?
Well, that's an enormous topic. Their environment is what they make of it. They can recreate whatever they want. So that afterlives are very individualized, and they depend a great deal on a person's cultural awareness, cultural background, influenced by that, by expectations and needs. But generally there is, if it's a good transit, because you can get locked up into hallucinations and whatnot, but if it's a good transit, generally you have a sense of extreme safety, extreme freedom, incredibly deep, a sense of a sort of an ineffable love in the background and of a luminosity that knows you. And these things seem to be cross-cultural. So that's a kind of a baseline for the afterlife. On the other hand, there are a lot of different types when a person has problems and whatever, but they get help. They get help from us, and they get help from the other side.
But where do they say they are at?
They're not at anywhere.
They're just a presence. They're,
you know, you can't have
their
an at when you're not, yeah, right.
They're simply it's just, conscious.
They're conscious, and they can show you their environments. Very often they're gardens or seascapes or whatever. But doesn't mean that that's where they are all the time.
Okay, but do they become a part of the larger universal consciousness?
They can tap into that. And these are gross generalities. That is the point, I think, is expanding to that point, yes. So you expand more and more of, include more and more of the human experience, and then more and more of experiences that are not necessarily human. That's what happens in the growth process. Absolutely.
My final question, since suicide is on a huge rise today, especially among young soldiers, veterans, and people, teenagers, what happens to these souls after death?
Well, again, there's no one rule. You have to, some of these soldiers, actually, we have records of people who 30 years thought they were in the same battle in World War II. Time stood still for them. Most of them will die. They float up together. Sometimes they go together. Sometimes they don't. They're usually met by someone. There's no one afterlife for any one situation. Even for suicides, every single one I have worked with is different from the next. Mm-hmm. And that's also true, Gary, with animals. Their deaths are also, their afterlives are also different and individualized for each one.
We really appreciate you sharing your insights with us. Thank you very much, and all the best with The Last Frontier. The website is JuliaAssante, ASSANTE.com. Appreciate you being on today.
Thanks, Gary.
And she's an academic, she's a professor, doctorate, Columbia University. Interesting dynamic. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now we go to the talkback part of our program, where you have a chance to call in. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And we have Luann Panessi on first, but we're going to take your call right behind her, so call now. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. That was pretty fascinating. That's something you don't hear every day.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to put anything on the people here every day.
I know that. Well, I have something here that I think is kind of worthy for your attention and certainly the attention of your audience. About two or three years ago, or even longer ago, you were talking about what you saw happening in the future. And you called what was going to happen in Greece. And sure enough, now we turn to Madrid. Thousands of people are protesting against the spending cuts and the allegations of government corruption in Spain. And there was a very peaceful march that convened last Saturday in front of Parliament under the watch of riot police. And, of course, there were a number of people that got arrested for peacefully demonstrating. 40 people were hurt, including 12 police. And this is just one of a number of demonstrations across the country to protest against deep austerity, which you've spoken about in the past, the privatization of public services, sound familiar, and the allegations of political corruption. So these protests in Spain have become commonplace, and the goal of the government is to quiet these people. So I would like to get your thoughts on this.
Spain is much larger than Greece. Its population dwarfs that of Greece. And the Spanish have had a very subsidized and very socialized environment, but also a very large private sector, larger than the government. And they took up the bubble, like all other countries, and the real estate market in Spain boomed. So young people in particular, and college graduates, went out and bought two and three homes or apartments and were flipping them. And then the bubble crashed. And then they wouldn't allow people to walk away from a mortgage which was underwater. Instead, you lost your home, but you still owed the full amount, plus interest and penalties. Now, if you're already too poor to pay a mortgage, how are you going to pay the mortgage after you've lost it? So the government of Spain, being one of the dumbest governments in the history of the world, said, okay, let's take these poor people and let's put austerity on them. So then they started cutting back on their social services and cutting back on subsidized food and fuel and electricity and privatizing everything they could. Then in came the vulture capitalist to buy up these dirt cheap assets and then turn around and manipulate them back into the marketplace. The people there were outraged. They thought their politicians would take care of them. Well, the politicians everywhere are all corrupt. Everywhere. You have a few individuals who are not, but the whole political system is based upon a corrupt model, especially in the United States. We're the most corrupt political system. You would think that Mexico or Russia or India, and they're all corrupt. I wouldn't trust anyone from any government, and especially I wouldn't trust anyone from our own. But at the end of the day, the people did trust. And so when they started going through these structural adjustments and loans from the European Bank and International Monetary Fund and these big bailouts from the bondholders, for every time they were given money, they had to give away more and more and more. So now the average Spaniard can't afford to stay in a home, but can't pay the debt that comes against them when they're out of it. They can't buy all the food they need. So they've engaged in peaceful demonstrations, but you cannot demonstrate anywhere in the world, in any country, peacefully, because all governments share the same fear that the citizens will gain power and throw them out. And that's exactly true. But the people never think they have that much power. And so they fight with their bodies and their minds and their hearts and rocks against total decimation machines. And we saw what they did with innocent people with Occupy Wall Street. You know, we saw the brutality. We saw the mindset, the militarized mindset to desensitize police to the suffering of those who are engaged in proper and peaceful demonstration. But where is it going to go? All you have to do is look ahead. What will happen? And I predict this. I predict that within the next 2 years, Spain will completely tear down its government. I mean, tear it down. Greece will do it sooner. And it's not because of the corrupt unions. And it's not because of the corrupt politicians. Not because of the corrupt oligarchy. And it's not because of the indifferent and corrupt bureaucrats. It's because of the disempowered youth. Historically, in the United States, we had a youth rebellion. We have no youth rebellion today because they have been commodified. They're passive. Remember, 99% of college students would never participate or support the 1% of the occupier. How ironic is that? So that shows you how indifferent and how conditioned the youth are. Not true in Greece, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, and Italy. There you will have people tearing down the government. You'll have massive civil protests. You'll have extreme violence. And then they will destroy the existing power structure. And then they will rebuild from the grassroots up. That's what I perceive in those countries. And it's close. It will not happen in the United States. But it will certainly happen there. Okay? Thank you. We're out of time. Let's say hello to Utrecht Lead. Hi, Utrecht.
Hello, Gary. Today, it's open phones and open forum day on Lead Stories. So listeners could bring to the table whatever they think is worthy of deeper examination.
Great. We look forward to it. Utrecht Lead. By the way, in Utrecht, I thought you'd like to know that I collect all the Arbitrons. And those are the monthly reports you get that shows you who's listening, where they're listening from, their age groups and all. You now have a larger audience listening to you on Progressive Radio Network each day than you had on WBAI years ago.
That's good to know.
Isn't that something?
That's great to know.
You also should know that WBAI is now averaging $9,600 a day in fundraising. Do you remember before the coup? There was never a counter coup. There was just a coup.
Yes.
Where they threw you and the progressive-minded people on the boards and stations out so they could have giveaway and steal the assets of the station, which they successfully did.
Well, but, let me just, one little correction there. Nobody threw me out. We all walked out in support of Bessie Wash, who was the executive director, who brought in a different style of management. I was one of the people, and there were other managers as well. And when she decided, she said she was going to quit, we all said, we are going to follow you right out the door.
Do you remember how much we average per day in fundraising, you and I, every day?
Oh, man.
$85,000 a day.
We would really burn up the air.
We were averaging, in fact, you and I had the largest single amount in the history of the station. We raised $66,000 in 1 hour. I was in the back seat of a cab being driven back from the Catskills where I did a lecture, and you were in the studio. We raised $1,180,000 in 14 days. Mm-hmm. So for those who thought they were really smart and knew everything and didn't need us and our audiences, and now they're raising $9,000 a day. Well, that's a lesson in reality.
That's pretty sad. It's pretty sad because, you know, it's such a very important and necessary asset to the community of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and portions of Pennsylvania. But it is also the case where people have hidden agendas that they don't readily confess or even talk about, but you see it in the end, it plays itself out, and we see what the situation really was. So,
you are right. We look forward to your, but the good news is you have your audience back and a new audience, and it's growing. I just wanted to let you know that.
Thank you very much, Gary. Yes, I see the response also on Facebook, which I'm getting to learn. It's been fantastic, really
good.
Reconnecting with people.
We look forward to you coming on in just a moment. Utrecht Lead right now on the Progressive Radio Network.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons. What do you get?